Hey, Robert.
Hey, Ron.
So, we've talked during some of the Ingenuism podcasts on about industrial planning and the attempts by governments to focus on particular industries and invest in particular industries and subsidize them and tariffs and just manage the economy more broadly. And we've talked about why that goes against many of the Ingenuism principles. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal the other day about kind of winners and losers of this kind of industrial planning. And they made the argument that, look, Biden administration is pouring all this money into, what is it, chips and into solar panels and into battery technology and all these other things. And it's $38 billion for chips, and it's another $50 billion for alternative energy things, and it's huge amounts of money. And nobody else can match this. So a lot of countries that would like to be in these industries are losing out, and they probably lose. Companies might leave those countries and come to the United States because they get a subsidy here. Maybe the Europeans can match some of this, although Europe's economy is not doing well, so they're struggling to be able to match it. But certainly, places like Singapore and maybe even South Korea and Japan are probably not in a position to match it right now. And so they're winners and losers. So, we're winning is the story, and there's a lot of in the press about how wonderful the U.S. economy is and giving complete credit to all these subsidies. And there are other people who are losing. So what? How does this Ingenuism perspective approach that kind of winner loser view of industrial policy?
Well, industrial policy is more complicated than we often give it credit for. It's kind of a team issue where if you're progressive on the left, you subsidize your favorite industries, and that's so you are supportive of industrial policy. And on the right, it's more free market, although that's becoming less and less true, I think. But the nuance is really obvious when you look at through the lens of Ingenuism. So when you first start with industrial policy, if you think about a country that is trying to industrialize, there's actually a level of connection that you're looking at. It is learning the lessons of what's worked for other countries in the past. That doesn't mean blindly accepting them, but there are certain policies that have worked in the past and other policies that have been abject failures. So you'll often see industrial policy be relatively successful. Now, relatively being an intentional term, because it's hard to know what would have happened in, well, I guess it's impossible to know in the counter example where something else was done. And there's always a huge opportunity cost to industrial policy. But if you're doing something that has been shown to work as it's implemented in other countries for at least a while, then there's at least an argument made for Ingenuism, that you're increasing your connection and you're starting to. And when I say that, it's not like connecting a wire. It's you're starting to learn the more subtle things associated with industrialization, what kind of training you need, what kind of the education system has to look like, and getting those sort of softer talents that are hard to quantify but incredibly important inside your country, so you can do more things. And it goes all the way. If you're in agriculture, you can still do this. You can mechanize, or you can bring technology to agriculture. So all of that is generally more successful than the kind of industrial policy, unfortunately, we're looking at today, which is taking something and trying to move it forward, trying to create innovation in an area to move chips forward or to move alternative energy forward, battery technologies, electric vehicles. All these things are existing technologies. And so you're already looking at something that's much more difficult, which is someone deciding somewhere who doesn't have the information or the incentives that you would think they would need to make good decisions about how you're going to actually apply this policy. And even then, it's not the worst of all scenarios. The worst is where we're going to be in 10 years, where you have a big group of you have a large group of companies that are recipients of these subsidies that now are only interested in trying to maximize the subsidies, are focused on technologies that were under the original mandate, which is now 10 years old. And we know from technology, the stuff that was most relevant 10 years ago is often irrelevant today. And so this sort of industrial policy is fraught with a sort of diminishing returns over time, not because it grows and takes all the low-hanging fruit, but because it's looking on the wrong tree over time. And so if you look at it through the lens of ingenuism, unless you're increasing connection, unless you're increasing learning, you're not going to be getting progress. So if you're learning the lessons that are possible for industrialization, then maybe it's going to be successful. If you're increasing learning, which is generally pushing through for new technologies, not trying to advance existing technologies, then it may be successful. Both cases, I'm not saying it will be or that it's better than the alternative, but there's definitely an argument for it. But when you take a industrial policy that doesn't have increased connection or learning feedback, learning from feedback built into it, then your chances of this actually driving progress are minimal.
I mean, the countries that are used as examples of successful industrial policy are countries like South Korea, even Taiwan, Singapore, and Japan post-World War II, countries where that had nothing. I mean, one of the true amazing statistics is that South Korea at the end of the Korean War was dramatically poorer than North Korea. And indeed stayed poor for quite a while. It's only in the late 70s, early 80s that it started to industrialize. But taking a baseline of basically zero and starting to build something on top of that, it seems like industrial policy, quote, works. Again, we don't know what the opportunity cost is. We don't know what the alternative is. They could have done other things, but at least we know that it works in the sense that it gets economies going. We also seem to know that it hits a brick wall, right? So South Korea's growth rate was capped at some point. Japan's growth rate was capped at some point. And arguably because the industrial policy had played out whatever benefits it had and now needed something else, maybe more ingenuism, more competition, more innovation, more connection, more learning. In all these countries, it kind of tapped out. And these countries have had a hard time making the adjustment to a more ingenuous, oriented, focused economic system. But to take the United States, which has at a base kind of built in, we have this mentality of ingenuism. We have structures that facilitate ingenuism, Silicon Valley, venture capital. We have robust educational institutions that interact with our companies in terms of innovation, that is connected to the global economy. And then to say, okay, somehow somebody in Washington, D.C. knows better than all these people who are experimenting and trying things out and have something at stake, that they know somehow better and that they're going to impose a solution onto the market, more chips, more batteries, more whatever. It even if you think that industrial planning worked for South Korea, doesn't, I think, make any sense in terms of what the United States does. And I agree with you in terms of what the long-term consequences inevitably will be.
And if you take the basic tenets of ingenuism, which are a trust in the fact that ingenuity will figure things out, and humility is a willingness to learn, industrial policy almost always lacks both. It doesn't have to. There's a hypothetical, we put a benevolent AI in charge and that would most of the time be answering questions I don't know, because that is, in fact, the answer to most questions in existence, is we don't have an answer yet. But that's just not how industrial policy has historically worked, particularly in the United States. And not only, if you look at the Wall Street Journal article, not only is it saying, there are winners, the people who are spending the most money, who are ratcheting up industrial policy the fastest, but there are losers in the smaller countries that can't afford to keep up. And that is just flies exactly in the face of ingenuism, because as long as those countries are connected, as long as they're not, pulling a North Korea or a Cuba, they are going to benefit from whatever comes out of all of those subsidies. Now, we're arguing that not that much is going to come out of them relative to what could have come out of all the time and energy and resources that are being directed by the central authority. But whatever does come out, even if it does turn out that there are huge advances, Those are going to be easily spread. That's the whole point of having a connected world. And the benefits will flow. And, you know, it's like saying, oh, well, the US invented the effective. And when I say the US, I mean companies that were largely in the US, because contributions came from all over the world, but invented the COVID vaccine, and then saying, but nobody else benefited. And that's, you know, arguably the greatest beneficiaries were countries that couldn't afford to develop the vaccine on their own and never would have had a vaccine, that eventually got the vaccine. And by eventually, we're talking about, you know, months, a year, not years or decades. And so that tone of the article that, you know, you poor Singapore, who actually has industrial policy, but can't keep up with it. Well, Singapore's industrial policy has historically been, and unfortunately, this depends on the people in charge making the right decisions, but it's historically been relatively modest in the sense of specific directions and micromanaging. And I think that's why it's been successful, again, relative to what it would be if you had more of a Soviet-style industrial policy where some central authority is making all the decisions without any of the information or any of the incentives that you need to make good decisions. And even when you have the right incentives and the information, most decisions we make are wrong in the long term. You know, they might be right now, they might be wrong right now, but close. As long as we're able to adapt and evolve, we end up in good places. And so, and that's ingenuism. And so if you have industrial policy that doesn't, not only doesn't empower that, but doesn't even allow it, then you're looking at very poor results long term.
Yeah, and part of where you can see the kind of benefits of industrial policy, whatever one thinks of the Apollo project and whether it was a good use of resources or not, or whether the government should have been involved in it or not, those resources were deployed by the government, and it didn't land a man on the moon. And as a consequence, lots of technologies were developed out of that. And the beneficiaries of those technologies were individuals and companies and, you know, who never went to the moon, who never invested in going to the moon. And they clearly did benefit from it. They benefited from the technology that the scientists and engineers developed in order to go to the moon, and then made products and innovations as a result of that, because it wasn't a secret thing. It wasn't contained. There was connection. There was learning. Everybody could see it. These engineers left their jobs at NASA and went to other places. There was this movement, which is what connection and learning is all about. And that generated a benefit, a win-win kind of across the entire economy.
And that's a great example of where it's doing something new, where you developed technologies to get first to the moon and then get human beings to the moon and back that didn't exist before. And those kind of projects, I don't know if they're efficient, I don't know what the opportunity cost, you know, but they do produce results. And if you look at the space program, incredible progress and then stagnation. Because what do you do next? Well, you try to get to the moon a little faster, or you try and build reusable space shuttles, but you don't really have the right incentives to evolve the technologies, to develop an existing technology and elevate it. Instead, you stagnate until SpaceX comes along and starts, you know, applying ingenuism to it. And the same thing, of course, is true with the COVID vaccine. Your point when we were talking the other day was, you know, the vaccine itself was worth $1 trillion plus, but the RNA technologies that were developed and I don't want to say perfected, because nothing is ever perfected, but made ready for prime time, you know, actually became useful.
Usable.
As part of that, could end up curing cancers, or, you know, if eliminating other viral diseases and bacterial diseases, who knows? But we're already seeing that progress, the spillover progress is happening, and it's going to make a huge difference in not just our lifetimes, but the rest of this decade.
No, and that's always true of innovation. So some of this innovation is funded by governments. Sometimes they get it right. I mean, the reality is that even if it's something new, a lot of the time when the government invests a huge amount of money in something new, they don't get the result, right? So Apollo is a great example of a positive. Most of the what do they call it, white elephants out there, you know, we don't even know about or we've forgotten about, have been deserted. And Japanese industrial policy has some great examples of stuff that the Japanese wanted to do and they weren't ready and they completely collapsed. So we forget about the failures. But the reality is that any new innovation, and this is the beauty of it, any new innovation is always going to have these spillover effects, right? I mean, think about all the people, all the companies, all the wealth created, not by Apple, but by companies using the iPhone in order to do more stuff. And the imagination of people in terms of what is possible that spurred on. So every innovation, no matter, as long as it's not secret, as long as the world is open, is going to generate enormous benefits, really globally, as long as the global economy is an open economy.
And that's why Ingenuism is so important, because it provides guide rails for what you're willing to sacrifice. And so you're willing to spend a bunch of money on a space program, or, you know, China spent an enormous amount of money trying to build a domestic, fully self-contained ship industry. And some of these are going to fail. When you take big, ambitious projects, you're going to fail. You're going to fail a lot. And the question is, do you learn from your failure? Do you pivot with your failure? And do you stop doing the things that aren't working? And building that into industrial policy is really hard. And then you also get in a sort of, this is the way it's done because the government says so, and then progress stagnates. I mean, that's what happened with nuclear energy. Nuclear reactors, which basically made marginal cost of zero energy, were an amazing development. And then nothing ever happened because the way they were being used was the only way they were allowed to be used. And you think, well, that's one example, but these examples everywhere, and it's usually not as obvious what the cost is. So when the European Union said, okay, all power charging has to be USB-C, you can't, basically Apple, you can't use the Lightning anymore because it's inconvenient for people to have two charging cords. Now we all have two charging cords or three because we have a USB micro as well. And it is a little inconvenient. I totally acknowledge that. And it doesn't seem like there's a big cost to having the iPhone go to USB-C. And yet what we are going to end up with is USB-C is the charging technology. And incremental improvements are going to be much more difficult. You know, something revolutionary that's fully wireless, that can sidestep the regulations, I don't think it'll stop. But the incremental progress that is most of progress, you don't get revolutionary. We didn't go from, you know, if you think about when your kids were small, you had strollers and they seemed amazing compared to the strollers of 50 years earlier. But strollers today are so much more amazing. They're not hoverboard strollers that have no wheels, and you know, but they fold up better, they're more durable, they steer more easily. Just freaking luggage. You look at luggage in our lifetime and how much better luggage has gotten, all by incremental improvements. Again, it's not that we can just teleport our stuff to our destination, which would be great, but in reality, most improvement is incremental. And when you have a subsidy for a particular technology or a regulation that dictates a particular technology, you tend not to get that incremental improvement that is so important in Ingenuism.
God, do you remember when luggage didn't have wheels? It's not that long
ago. I do. And then I remember when it was two wheels in the wrong spot. So they would, and they didn't spin, so it would fall over. It was basically, if you kept an exact straight line, you could, and that was amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, today it's, you know, kids today, they don't understand how good they have it.
They don't know what it's like to go uphill in the snow both directions to school.
Yes, with luggage that is fighting you all the way. Although I would love to have hovering luggage. You could use escalators and stuff a lot more easily. But
I think they'd at least be motorized luggage, right? They've got these tiny little engines. They should have motorized luggage, and you should be able to stand on the luggage and just.
It's basic. I've seen they make luggage for kids that they can sit on, and yeah, basically scoot.
Yep. So that's cool.
It is actually pretty cool, but I don't think it's as popular because I think there's a lot of liability that
I've seen them at airports. I've seen a lot of families using them. I don't think adults are going to be, you know, adults need the steps. The kids don't need them.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. Thanks, Robert. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Ron. Bye.